Chapter 7. The ride up to their house in Marin County made me carsick, due to the sharp turns through Samuel P. Taylor Park. On each turn, I thought Charlie was going to leave the road. Both he and Faye knew the road so well that they knew exactly how far up they could push the gas pedal on each turn. 1 mile an hour more and the car would have gone off into the creek. At one time, he hit 60 miles an hour. Most drivers would have had to take it at 25, especially those weekend drivers who putter along. And Charlie used the whole road, not just his lane. He went all the way over to the shoulder on the far side. He seemed to know whether a car was coming or not, even though I could see nothing but trees. Faye did not show any signs of nervousness beside him in the front seat. In fact, she seemed to be half asleep. But around me, all my goods slid and rocked. What an odd sensation it was to have them with me in motion, not back at the room. For all intents and purposes, I had given up my room. Now I was going to live with my sister and her husband at their house. I had no actual place of my own. It was like going back to childhood, and I felt depressed and uncomfortable. However, the scenery cheered me up, and I knew from their description what sort of a house it was. I knew that it was very swanky, with all the latest gadgets. To keep my spirits up, I thought of the animals. At one time during high school, I had worked for a veterinarian, sweeping out, cleaning the cages, helping people bring their pets in from their cars, feeding the animals boarded there, getting rid of dead animals. I had enjoyed being around the animals. And long ago, when I was about 11, I had spent a lot of time catching insects and making analyses of them. I had taken apart those giant yellow slugs. I used to catch flies and hang them from loops of thread. However, the weight of the fly's body was usually too slight to close the noose, so I usually had to pull down on the fly. At that point, the fly's eyes would pop from his head and his head would come off. When we arrived at the house, Charlie helped me carry my boxes of possessions indoors and to a room in the rear that they had decided to present me for my use. Evidently, they had used it for storage. We had to carry out one armload after another of garden tools, children's discarded games and toys, even a bed that the collie dog had spent time in. Shutting myself in the room, I began putting my clothes in the closet and setting out my things, trying to give this new room an air of familiarity. With scotch tape, I put up various important facts on the walls. I inserted items from my rock collection into the corners. Last of all, for a time, I put my head in the bag containing my collection of milk bottle tops and breathed in the rich, sour odor of the bottle tops, a smell that had been with me since the fourth grade. That raised my spirits, and I looked out of the window for the first time. Dinner that night made me conscious of the luxury in which my sister was now living. Outdoors on the patio, she had Charlie broiling T-bone steak in a charcoal pit, while inside, she fixed hors d'oeuvres of minced clams and cream cheese baked on English muffins, martinis, avocado salad, baked potatoes, Italian beans from their freezer that they had originally grown themselves. And for dessert, huckleberries that they had picked the summer before somewhere out near the point. They had coffee. The two children and I had milk. And the children and I had whipped cream on our huckleberries. After dinner, I carried the children around on my back while Faye and Charlie sat in the living room having a second martini and listening to long hair music on the hi-fi. In the fireplace, they had a fire of oak logs from the cords stacked up near the side of the house. I don't think I have ever enjoyed such comfort, and I threw myself into playing with the girls, getting a great kick out of swinging them around, tossing them high up and recatching them, hiding from them and letting them find me. Their yells seemed to annoy Faye, and all at once she got up to go put the dishes in the automatic dishwasher. Later, I helped put the children to bed. I read a story to them from the Oz book. It made me feel strange to be reading one of the stories that I knew so well. Books so much a part of my life, and these children had not even been born until the 50s. They hadn't even been alive during World War II. I realized that this was the first time I had ever had anything to do with children. "You sure have nice kids," I said to Faye, after we had left the children's rooms. Faye said, Everybody says that, so it must be true. Personally, I find them a lot of work. You enjoy playing with them, but after they've pestered you day in, day out for years, wait till you got up every morning at 7 and fixed breakfast for them. Fixing breakfast was one thing my sister hated. She liked to lie in bed late until 9 or 10, and with the girls in school, she had no choice but to get up early. Charlie, of course, had to be off to his factory, so he could not take the responsibility of dressing the girls, brushing their hair, preparing their lunches, seeing that they had their books, and so forth. After a week or so, I found that I did not mind getting up early and setting the table, putting on water for the cream of wheat, making the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and filling the thermos jugs with tomato soup, opening the drapes, frying bacon, cutting open the grapefruit, buttoning the girls' dresses, and then, after I had served breakfast to them, clearing the table, washing the dishes, taking out the garbage and trash, and finally sweeping the floor around the breakfast table. Meanwhile, Charlie got shaved, dressed, ate his soft-boiled egg, toast, and coffee, and set off for Petaluma. At 9 or so, Faye got up, took a shower, dressed, carried a cup of coffee and a dish of applesauce out onto the patio, ate, read the Chronicle, if somebody had thought to go out and get it for her, and then sat by herself smoking a cigarette. Not only did I enjoy fixing breakfast, but I also enjoyed babysitting in the evenings, and that was a godsend for Faye. It meant that once again she could begin getting out and visiting people. She could get down to the Bay Area to movies and plays and classes. She could even go 3 times a week to her analyst in San Francisco instead of only once. And because they did not have to worry about keeping me up late, as they had had to do with teenage babysitters, they could stay as late in the city as they wanted, going to parties or bars. And on Friday morning, I went with my sister to Petaluma and carried the groceries for her, putting everything away when we got home, and even burning the leftover bags and cartons in the incinerator. In exchange for all this, I got truly wonderful meals, and I got to ride the horse and play games with the kids. A metal pole had been erected outdoors for tetherball, and the children and I played tetherball almost every afternoon. I got really skilled at it.
"You know," Charlie said to me once, "you missed your vocation. You should have been a playground director or worked for the YMCA. I never saw anybody take to kids so. The noise doesn't bother you. That's what bothers me."
In the evenings, he always looked tired. I said, "I think parents should spend more time with their kids." "How can they help it?" Faye said. "Good God, the kids are underfoot all the time. Kids grow up better if adults don't interfere with them too much. They should be let alone." She was glad to have me babysit and play with the girls, but she did not approve of my mixing into the continual quarrels that the girls had with each other. She had always simply let them fight it out, but I soon saw that the older girl, being more advanced intellectually and much heavier physically, always won. It was not fair, and I felt required to step in. "The only way kids can learn what's justice is if adults teach them," I said to Faye. "What do you know about justice?" Faye said. "Here you are, up here in my house, freeloading. How'd you get up here anyhow?" She glared at me with that half-serious, half-joking exasperation that I was familiar with. She had this way of mixing a serious statement in with irony, so that it was never possible to tell how seriously she meant what she said. "Who brought you here?" she demanded. In my own mind, I had no guilt. I was giving back plenty for what I took. I did a great deal of Faye's housework for her, and by babysitting, I made it possible for them to save a lot of money. On an average, babysitting alone had run them $3 a night, and over a period of a month, this sometimes added up to $60 or $70. All these figures I recorded in my notebooks. I calculated how much I cost them and how much I saved them. The only real cost that I added to their budget was that of food, but I was not eating $60 worth of food a month, so by babysitting alone I earned my keep. I didn't add appreciably to the heating bill or the water, although of course I did bathe and wash, and my clothes had to be put into the automatic washer, and I went around turning off lights not in use and lowering thermostats when people left rooms.
So in my estimation, such a thing is admittedly very hard to estimate, I actually saved them money on their utility bills. And by riding the horse, I prolonged his life, since not being ridden, he was getting overly fat, which put an unnatural strain on his heart. More than anything else, however, and something that could not be calculated in dollars and cents, I improved the atmosphere regarding the children. In me, they had someone who cared about them, who enjoyed playing with them and listening to them and giving them affection. I did not consider it a duty or a chore. I took them on long walks, bought them bubble gum at the store, watched Gunsmoke with them on TV, cleaned up their rooms. And that's another thing. By doing heavy household work such as scrubbing the floors, I made it possible for Faye to let Mrs. Mandini, her cleaning woman, go. Consider that Mrs. Mandini's presence had always annoyed Faye. She felt that Mrs. Mandini was listening to everything anybody said, and Faye had always liked privacy. That was one of her major motives for desiring a large house isolated in the country. One Saturday afternoon, when Faye had gone into San Rafael to shop, and the two girls were over at Edith Kiever's place playing with her children, Charlie started talking to me out in the field by the duck pen. He had been running a new pipe to the duck's water trough.
"Doesn't it bother you to do housework?" he asked me.
"No," I said.
"I don't think a man should do that kind of stuff," he said. Later on, he said, "I don't think that the girls should see a man doing it either. It gives them the idea a man can be bossed around by a woman."
To that, I said nothing. I could think of nothing pertinent.
Charlie said, "She can't get me to do her goddamn errands."
"I see," I said politely.
"A man has to keep his self-respect," Charlie said. "Doing housework robs him of his masculinity."
I had noticed, almost as soon as I had moved in with him, how touchy Charlie was with her. He seemed to resent her asking him to do anything, even helping her around the garden. One night, when she asked him to open a can or a jar for her, I didn't see it clearly, although I came in from my room to watch, he blew up, threw the jar down on the floor, and started calling her names. I noted that in my records, because I could perceive a pattern. Once a week or so, Charlie would go off by himself, usually down to the Western Bar, or a bar in Olema that he liked, and get tanked up on beer. That seemed to be his system for getting his resentment of my sister out in the open. Otherwise, it merely simmered away down inside him, making him quarrelsome and moody. But when he had had a few drinks, he could threaten her physically. I never saw him actually hit her, but I could tell by her response, when he came home from the bar, that at such times she was genuinely afraid of him. I don't think she realized why he drank, that he was releasing stored-up resentment. She thought of it more as a character defect on his part, and possibly a defect common with all men. Each time he went off drinking, she became more businesslike with him. She shafted him with quiet, rational upbraiding. Over a period of time, she managed to convince him that there was something wrong with him for going out and drinking and coming home and taking a few swings at her. Instead of viewing it as a simple means of working off steam, she chose to consider it a symptom of some deep, pervasive, even dangerous malformation in him. Or possibly she only pretended to think that. In any case, it was her policy to regard him as a malformed man, one who should be matched, and by talking along this line, she made hay from each of his binges. The more he resisted her by going out and getting drunk and coming home and taking a swing at her, the more she built up this picture of him. And it was a picture that, when not drunk, he too had to accept. The household was pervaded by this atmosphere of a calm adult woman and a man who gave in to his animal impulses. She reported to him in great detail what her analyst, Dr. Andrews in San Francisco, said about his binges and his hostility. She used Charlie's money to pay Dr. Andrews to catalog his abnormalities. And of course, Charlie never heard anything directly from the doctor. He had no way of keeping her from reporting what served her and holding back what did not. The doctor, too, had no way to get at the truth of what she told him. No doubt she only gave him the facts that suited her picture,
so that the doctor's view of Charlie was based on what she wanted him to know. By the time she had edited it, both going and coming, there was little of it outside her control. Like any slob, Charlie grumbled at her going to the doctor, and at the same time took as holy writ whatever she reported. Any man who charged $20 an hour had to be good. Sometimes I asked myself what she was up to, if anything. I had nothing to do in the early afternoons after I had done the lunch dishes, and I now and then sat around and watched her mold clay pots or knit or read. She had turned out to be a good-looking woman, although she had little or no bust line, and she had this big modern house with 10 acres and all the rest of it. Beyond any doubt, she was unhappy. But she wanted something she lacked. After a month or so, I came to the conclusion that she simply wanted Charlie to be different from what he was. She had a deeply ingrained image of what a husband should be like. She was always very choosy. And although in some respects he met her requirements, in others he did not. For instance, he had enough money to build this house, and he did most of the things she wanted. And he was reasonably good-looking. But for one thing, he was a slob, and there has always been this aristocratic, disapproving, judging tendency in Faye. It showed up strongly in high school, when she began to work toward going to college. She took courses in literature and history, and felt that the girls who took cooking courses, and the boys who took shop courses, were the riffraff of the world. Beyond any doubt, Charlie didn't care for what she regarded as the civilized things in life, such as the long hair music she listened to on the hi-fi. I grant that he was a slob, but he was a slob when she married him. He was a slob that day in the roadside grocery store when he mistook the Mozart tune for a hymn. If she knew that, then she was wrong to disapprove of him, as if it was some secret trait that he had concealed from her and then sprung on her after they were married. My God, Charlie had always been completely honest with her, and he had given her everything in his power. Now, instead of driving his Mercedes, he drove a Buick because she preferred the color schemes and the automatic shift. In his own area, such as with cars, he knew more than she did. She was the barbarian, the slob. But that did not help him, since she did not choose to regard those areas as important. The fact that he could lay a good pipeline to the duck's trough did not impress her. Only slobs were good at that, and so her point was proved. And yet she accepted, even used, his language. I suppose that she was ambivalent about him, that on the one hand she thought of him as rough and masculine, which was vital to her. He qualified as a man sexually. What she wanted was, it seems to me, paradoxical. She wanted him to be a man, but at the same time to meet her own standards. And these standards, having been set for herself, were not a man's standards. On that point, her own sex, she had some confusion too. She hated to do housework, I think, because it made her feel like a woman, and this was intolerable to her. No wonder Charlie loathed doing her chores for her. If it was degrading for her to do them, surely it was worse for him. Not because of his feelings about them. At one time he might not have minded, but because of their insignificance to her. Doing housework proved that a person was a drudge, a domestic, a servant, a maid. She could not bring herself to do them, but she was willing to let her husband do them. She could not, for example, bear to go down to the store and buy her Tampax. It was the sine qua non of proof that she was a woman, and so she got him to do it. Naturally, he came home and hit her. But I didn't mind doing the housework, because for me it was a job, not a symbol. I got my meals in return, and a warm house. I got something back, and it seemed just to me. Living with them, I was much happier and more satisfied than I had ever been at any time in my life, before or since. I liked being with the children and the animals. I liked building fires in the fireplace. I liked the barbecued steaks. Wasn't it more degrading for me to work for Poity at his tiry grooving place? The oddest part was Faye's feeling that this house belonged to her, and that Charlie, her husband, was somebody who came in and sat down in a chair and got that chair dirty. He sweated on the furniture. But again, this might not have been her actual attitude, but more a pose. She might simply have wanted to keep the idea current that this was primarily her house, and that in the house her laws functioned. Down underneath, she may have recognized perfectly well that without Charlie and his money, there would have been no house. But, like the drinking, a particular theory fitted her needs, and so she entertained the theory. She let him know that the house was her sphere, and what did that leave him? An office down at his factory to work in at night, plus the factory itself, and possibly the outdoors surrounding the house, the bare, unimproved fields. And this, too, Charlie tended to accept, because first of all, he wasn't as quick with his tongue as she. And in the final analysis, he imagined that since she was more intelligent and educated than he, then she must, when they disagreed, be right. He considered her much the same as a book or a newspaper. He might grumble against it, denounce it, but ultimately what it said was true. He had no faith in his own ideas. Like everyone else, he too recognized himself as a grade-A slob. Take their friends, for instance. Take the Antilles. Both of them, Gwen and Nat, were obviously university people who had shared her interests in cultural and scholarly subjects. Here was a man, another man, not a woman, who showed up and sat around discussing not business or plowing techniques, but medieval religious sects. Fay and the Antilles could communicate, and so it became 3-1, not 1-1. Charlie used to listen a while and then go off to his study to do paperwork. This was true not only with the Antilles, but with the Feinbergs and the Meritons and all the rest of them. Artists, dress designers, university people who had moved up to Inverness. All of them belonged to her, not him.